Reporter William Longavisha has traveled around the world, first for The Atlantic magazine and now for Vanity Fair. Over the years, he's also been an occasional guest on this program. We've talked to him about his stories about the death of 24 men, women, and children killed by United States Marines in Haditha in Iraq in 2005. He stopped by to talk about his reporting on the massive new American embassy being built in the Green Zone in Baghdad and shared his account of the nine-month cleanup period of the World Trade Center towers after they were destroyed in New York. For all that traveling, William Longavisha has never been to China until this past winter when Vanity Fair sent him there. When his reporting was done, he wrote a short essay, a letter home, as he calls it, recounting his impressions of Beijing as the city gets ready to host the Olympic Games this summer. If you've read the piece or if you have questions about China and its preparations for the game, give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And you can find a link to the Vanity Fair piece there. William Longavisha joins us now from our bureau in New York, and nice to have you back on the program today.
I'm glad to be here.
And you write that Beijing is the perfect venue for the Olympics. How come?
Well, my view of the Olympics, I mean, let me remind you, this is a letter home, so it's very informal and very frank. My view of the Olympics is not very charitable. I mean, I see the Olympics as being about sports to some degree, but largely about nationalism and exercise and nationalism and flag waving and sort of the pumping up of the idea of government and the nation state. And Beijing itself is much the same, architecturally at least.
Architecturally, these grand boulevards that, go beyond anything in Moscow or Berlin or Washington, D.C., for that matter.
I think of Beijing as being the most totalitarian city, cityscape in the world today, and I think there's really no question of that. I cannot think of any other city that has gone so far to such an extreme in the glorification of political power and the state and the authority of the state. So yes, I mean, this is a highly authoritarian environment, not just mentally and politically, but physically. And then you stir in the Olympics with its nationalist tendencies, and the mix is not a pretty one.
Describe for us, if you will, queuing day. Every 11th of every month is queuing day. What's that?
Well, it's part of the larger effort in Beijing to get the population to behave according to primarily to Western standards of good behavior in preparation for the visitors who will come in for the Olympics. Several hundred thousand people will arrive for this spectacle. And so the Chinese government is doing all sorts of things to prepare the scenery, including the human scenery, for these visitors. They ask people now to practice standing in orderly lines, sort of Germanic lines, on the 11th of every month. And the 11th was chosen because the two numerals 1 and 1 represent the expected behavior of standing in line.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the thing is that people do it. So, the sort of the totalitarian culture of China runs deep.
Indeed, you draw a lot of analogies to Berlin Olympics in 1936.
Well, we know that the Olympics were born as an exercise in nationalism. They were basically born in the 19th century with primarily false memories back to an imagined Greek thing. And it's a very modern phenomenon. And then came, of course, the Nazis with their famous Olympics before the war. The torch ceremony, the carrying of the torch, the marathon, whatever you call it, the relay, it was an invention of Joseph Goebbels, the propagandist. And this seems to have been forgotten, but not by me. And maybe because of my German last name, this stuff rubs me the wrong way. And I'm free to express that in a frank letter home like this.
You also talk about, yes, the Olympics surely are about sports to some degree, but the extent to which the Chinese and many of their visitors are focusing on the opening ceremonies.
The opening ceremonies and to some degree the closing ceremonies. Of course, this is really what concerns the officials most. It's very clear they're open about this. They're not hiding that. That is their biggest. They say first impressions matter most, which is a bogus idea. In fact, first impressions do not matter most. Long-term, deep impressions matter most. But they're hung up on these opening ceremonies with the synchronized crowd movements and the flags. And the same is true of the visitors. So the various very important persons, as they call them, meaning primarily heads of state, are also lined up for that ceremony, for the opening ceremony, for the closing ceremony. The interest in the actual athletic events is much less by the governments. I'm not saying by the people themselves, but by the governments.
And there's any number of ironies, including the Chinese preparations to kowtow, if you will, to the various royals who are going to be arriving to participate in these ceremonies. And the very contradiction of a China booming economically, yet it's still a communist government.
Well, the communism in China is nominal only, of course. I mean, the egalitarian ideal has long been forgotten in China. Now we have the spectacle of a government which is communist in name, but is primarily just interested in power. And I just to give them credit, probably also they feel that their exercise of power, as opposed to the exercise by alternative people in China, is crucial to the economic development of the country. They probably feel that they're doing a very good job and that other people could not do as good a job. In other words, they probably have the typical arrogance of government leaders to take credit for good times when good times happen to come.
Rebellion and its close cousin creativity, you write, are in short supply in China.
Very much. I heard in China, often the idea, the expression that the Chinese are individualists, but I saw very little evidence of that. It seems to be a highly imitative place. I call it in this letter home, I call it one giant karaoke bar. And the impression I had was that people are just really quite reluctant, if not afraid, to sing the wrong lines. And this is not just a matter of government repression, though certainly in places like the autonomous provinces or Tibet, it is a matter of repression. And for true political dissidents, it is a matter of repression. But for most people who go about their daily lives, it's more of a voluntary thing, which is, if anything, well, equally shocking, let's say.
Well, let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Our guest, of course, William Longavisha, international correspondent, now for Vanity Fair. His story called Beijing's Olympic Makeover appears in the April issue of the magazine. 800-989-8255 is our phone number. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Tom is on the line with us from Lansing, Michigan.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air, Tom. Go ahead,
please. Hi, thank you. I was wondering, what with the recent rise of a sense of Chinese nationalism amongst kind of the average Chinese person, I'm kind of wondering how that plays into the average Chinese person's view of these Olympic Games, like how important it is to them, you know, for their sense of being Chinese, you know.
Let me tell you, first of all, I mean, emphasize that I am not an expert on China. I am a casual visitor writing sort of impressionistic visions home. However, having said that, it's obvious that the Olympics play a very large role in what you could say is in the average Chinese consciousness of what China is. And people are proud of this. And people are truly, apparently, upset by the protests, for instance, in France or elsewhere around this Olympic torch ceremony. That comes as a surprise and a disappointment to me. But, of course, people are people. And you would expect, I would hope, I would wish that people in China would have reacted the way I would have wanted my ancestors in Germany to have reacted to the torch ceremony, and that is that any trouble that can be given, any demonstration that can be given, should be welcomed by the people of China, not abhorred. It should have been welcomed by the people of Germany. I'm not saying that China is Nazi Germany, but I'm saying that the healthy attitude toward such blatant manipulation of nationalist emotions and symbols is to reject those symbols and to welcome those who reject them. I am disappointed, personally, by the widespread Chinese reaction to the protests, although I fully understand them and I accept that people are people.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay. Tell us about the Capital Ethics Development Office, which you visited, which has been created to try, as you write, to whip Chinese citizens into shape before the Olympics. I guess Queuing Day was part of their campaign.
Right. It's to whip the residents of Beijing, roughly 15 million residents of Beijing, into shape. It's part of the campaign to clean up Beijing. They have campaigns against swearing in public places, against spitting, and rambunctious behavior at sporting events. They want people to be docile and to conform to Western standards of polite behavior. There, hand in hand with that, there are surveys that are made. They're made every year by a university there, and they showed, for instance, the latest numbers for last year for 2007. They showed, for instance, that public spitting has been reduced by 2.41%, and littering is down by 2.44%. They also have something they call the Civic Index, which is a measure of appropriate behavior and positive attitudes toward the Olympics, and that's up by 4.32%. So this is the sort of stuff that they actually put out seriously and expect people to swallow without a smile. I mean, there's no irony here, and that is probably a cultural difference. I mean, I think the more fundamental point is that the Chinese government, and I'm not talking about the Chinese people now, but the government, seems to believe that the rest of the world does not already have a basically correct idea of what China is. I mean, the spectacle of these small improvements in the sort of the facades of Beijing is surprising because it implies that the world does not already know. But of course, the world already knows and has basically a lot of sympathy with at least with the Chinese people, if not with the Chinese government, and is glad that growth has come to China, that wealth is coming to some degree at least to China, though it is no longer distributed very evenly, and also abhors the political repression and the totalitarian aspects of modern China, and also, of course, the pollution. So I mean, the world, people are hip to this. I mean, people know what's going on in China. So the spectacle of the Chinese trying to gloss over Beijing is peculiar, to say the least.
William Longavisha of Vanity Fair. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Randy. Randy calling us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hi. I was in China last year. I was in Xinjiang province, which is the far west of China, the Wild West. And I would take issue with one thing that your guest is saying, and that is that I don't see anything sinister in the Chinese government trying to teach the people to queue up, because my experience was there are over a billion people in China. They really need to learn to queue up. I nearly got trampled to death trying to cross the border into Kazakhstan, and I don't think that that's an atavistic throwback to some sort of Nazi-era nationalism. I think it's just good manners.
Well, I'm certainly not claiming that this is an evil thing by any means. That's simply not the point. I never made that point. I don't make it now. I mean, if you were in that part of China, I presume you were around Kashi, and where I also was recently. And as you realize that, you know, whatever problems you may have had with being run over by people in queues, there are far more serious problems politically going on there with political repression of minorities. But I'm
Absolutely.
Sure you know that.
Right? Especially the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
Yes, that's
province.
Correct. That's correct.
Thanks very much for the call, Randy.
Thank you.
So long. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Walker. Walker with us in Portland, Oregon.
Yes, I'd been in China, in Beijing, about 10 years ago, and the pollution, you had mentioned pollution earlier, was so bad they got what we affectionately called the Beijing hack. If you were there for any period of time, you came down with some sort of a chest congestion. I'm wondering if it's the same thing, and if so, are they planning on doing anything about it? And if they do something about it, wouldn't it be interesting, the irony of them actually being able to clean up the air pollution in Beijing and prove the whole world that Beijing can do anything?
Well, someday, presumably, if economic development continues and they pass the stage of just of unchecked growth and make that decision, there it's perfectly within the possibilities that they will be able to clean up their air pollution. There's no sign of it now. I mean, the measures being taken are temporary, the shutting down of construction sites, the limitations on certain traffic, on the burning of coal upwind of the stadiums where the Olympics are going to be played out. So I mean, this is window dressing right now. But of course, in the long run, China is as capable or more capable, as capable as any other country. But once it makes the political and economic choice to clean up its air, it will clean up its air if it makes that choice.
Thank you, Walker.
Great, thank you.
Bye-bye. And finally, William Longavisha, you, at the end of your letter from Beijing, say that the Chinese century that we've all been led to expect is going to happen, you don't think it's going to happen.
I see very little creativity in China. I realize that no one goes to China now, today, to learn anything about anything other than China itself. This is not a good sign for the future of China. Now, this can change, of course, but the political system would have to allow it to change. And if the political system allows for innovation and creativity and the expression of intelligence, and God knows China is full of the potential for all of that, but if the political regime, the communists in power, if they allow for that, they will be overthrown. So there's sort of a paradox at play. And it's clear that as long as such a fundamentally repressive regime remains in power, China will not be what it is said to be, or what it is said that it will become. So that's quite clear to me. Now, revolutions are always possible.
William Longavisha, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
William Longavisha, Vanity Fair's international correspondent. His essay called Beijing's Olympic Makeover appears in the April issue of the magazine. You can find a link to his article on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And he joined us from our bureau in New York. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how the Pentagon manages its message in another broadcast from the museum here in Washington, D.C. Please join us. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News.